This episode is sponsored by Drogba Studio. If you're a Salesforce ISV and you're thinking, should we even bet on the Salesforce ecosystem? Or our partner program exists, but it's not driving revenue. This is for you. Drogba Studio helps ISVs build a repeatable partner process. Clear partner profile, clear co-sell motion, clear messaging, and playbooks your alliances and marketing teams can run without chaos. It's led by Justin Edelstein, who spent 15 years running a Salesforce SI. So this is based on how SIs and AEs work in the real world. Learn more at drogbastudio.com. D-R-O-G-B-A studio.com. Welcome to Assembly Line, the podcast for entrepreneurs building on the Salesforce platform. We'll go behind the scenes with innovative founders and leaders to share their stories, strategies, and lessons to accelerate your own path to success as a Salesforce ISV. Are you looking to connect with the most dedicated founders and builders in the Salesforce ecosystem? The Assembly Line audience is made up of the exact ISV partners and entrepreneurs you're trying to reach. We're opening up a few sponsorship slots to partner with brands that can truly help our listeners succeed. If you're ready to connect with the leaders of the AppExchange, you can learn more at assemblyline.com/sponsor. That's assemblyline.com/sponsor. Today, I'm joined on the show by Catherine Castle of Candy Box. Thanks for joining, Catherine.
Thanks, Scott. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, so I'm looking forward to getting into your history and background of Candy Box and how y'all built your newly released custom quote sync app on the AppExchange. So maybe we can just start from your background, how you founded Candy Box, and then transition into the application itself.
Yeah, sure. So to set context a little bit, Candy Box is a professional services company. We're consultants. We primarily work with B2B SaaS companies, mostly in like the SMB to growth stage. Mm-hmm. So they're often fairly early in their Salesforce/RevOps journey. And then they grow, through their engagement with us, if all goes well. How I started the company, it was really happenstance. I'm currently based out of Mexico, but before that, I lived in the Netherlands for some time. And when I moved out here, I left my old job and I started contracting. My background was in business systems at a tech company, similar to mm-hmm. the ones that we work at now. So I had a pretty good network at that point. So I started contracting for one company and they told me at some point, I think now incorrectly, that in order to be correctly classified as a contractor, I needed multiple clients. And so I thought, okay, well, I guess I'll see if I can find another client. But I wasn't sure at that point how easy it would be to do. So I was plugging my network. What actually happened was I ended up with, I think, 5 different clients. And so I started working with all of them. It quickly got very busy. I started hearing this similar sort of refrain from them where they were saying, wow, it's so refreshing to work with a consultant who actually understands the tech space and all of our many acronyms and like our team structure and how we do things. And so I got this idea like, hey, maybe there is actually a gap in the market for a specialist agency that works specifically with these types of companies. And that's pretty much where Candy Box came from.
Okay. And what year were you, was it when you were told you need to have multiple clients and so you went out, you were voluntold to go get more projects?
Yeah, voluntold. It was, I think, 2019.
Okay. Interesting. I wonder if that has anything, I know at one point in California, they had passed a law, I think, there was a lot of question marks about Uber drivers and Lyft drivers and are they contractors, are they employees? And I think California passed some litigation. And one of the easy identifiers was multiple clients. Perhaps that's what they were leaning into at the time. I'm not sure.
Yeah, but it might have been that, or it might have been, I think, a mix up with some Dutch law because previously. But honestly, I don't know. Maybe it was correct, but hey, you know, it worked out for me. So
I mean, either way, it works. Yeah, I was gonna say, yeah. It's a good marching orders there. I would say.
Yeah, it was a bit of a forcing function.
And so could you expand a little bit on? Obviously, you were alluding to the fact that y'all are specialized in a specific vertical in cloud. Could you expand on that a little bit more?
Yeah. So the vast majority of our customers, when they start working with us, are relatively early stage tech companies. They usually say like Series A or B, although mm-hmm. we do have some companies who start at a stage of more maturity. They will often already have Salesforce in place, although some of them are looking to do a migration or an implementation. And they may have somebody doing RevOps in-house, but sometimes they don't. But usually the struggle is like, even if they do have a RevOps persona in-house, there's just so much to do when you're setting up the foundations of how you're going to operate your go-to-market systems. Mm-hmm. You know, so one person has to fulfill this kind of strategic role, like how are RevOps going to work at this company? And then they also have to do the execution. And it's really difficult to split your time that way. Even if you have like both strategic experience and technical capabilities, but a lot of people don't have both of those capabilities. So we will often come in to sort of fill that gap in a way and work as a thought partner to whoever is in-house and help companies avoid a lot of those early pitfalls that come from not thinking or not having the time or the right personnel to set up your revenue operations and your go-to-market systems correctly. So like if you don't set up a firm foundation, usually what will end up happening like a year, a couple years down the line is you just have a load of tech debt or you mm-hmm. have processes and systems and technologies that don't work for the company anymore. And you'll end up with a situation like you have 5 deal desk reps that you've had to hire because every single quote has errors because things weren't set up correctly and you need somebody to check every single one of them manually, or people are using Salesforce, but they go to do their reporting outside in spreadsheets because they know that the data isn't trustworthy. So we're hoping to avoid those types of problems and various others.
Sure. I imagine too, at the size company you're talking about, early stage growth to SMBs, there are so many fires to put out that it's easy for employees of that company to just build up that technical debt just to get something done, anything done, and go back to focusing on whatever their core service offering or product is, right? So that makes sense that if they can't offload to someone like Candybox to get things done properly, that's a good idea. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're helping out specifically with RevOps with early stage growth, SMBs, specifically kind of as an SI partner. Obviously, though, you and I are chatting about this new application that you just released on the AppExchange, Custom Quote Sync. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, for sure. So Custom Quote Sync, it's a free application on the AppExchange. And it was born of one of my team, actually, Brent. I want to make sure I give him a big shout out.
Big props to Brent.
Yes, very, the biggest of all props. So essentially, we actually use the quote object a lot in our builds with customers. Like, it's not always the most popular object. I think sometimes it's overlooked, but it can be really, really useful when you're building out early CPQ processes before, you know, going to the extent of actually buying like a full-fledged CPQ solution. Mm-hmm. But the native syncing functionality in Salesforce is a little bit limited. Custom fields don't sync out of the box. So if you want to sync custom fields, which most companies will end up wanting to do that, you have to kind of build workarounds, or you end up with a lot of errors that you're always having to fix. So our Quote Sync app, it addresses that issue. Brent told me that it was kind of inspired by the idea of twin fields in CPQ, which I have to admit I'm not super familiar with, but I imagine it follows a similar architecture. Mm-hmm. And basically this issue came up again and again across our accounts. And we do find that to happen a lot, like because we're specialists, we end up addressing the same issues over and over again. And that leads to us being able to develop almost like package solutions in a lot of cases, you know, like best practices for how to address X scenario or Y scenario. So it got to a point where we were just doing the same thing over and over again to address customers who had issues syncing quotes and opportunities. And Brent had the idea, you know, what if we just turn this into, you know, an App Exchange app and we offer it for free, seeing as we're more or less doing that on an ad hoc basis already. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's essentially where the idea came from.
That's great. So I can see how, one of the challenges people have with consulting in general, mm-hmm. I think, and a lot of SI partners can hit, is they cast too wide of a net and they try to be generalists. And then first off, it's difficult with marketing, because if you're if you do everything, then it can be perceived that you're an expert in nothing. And similarly, if you do narrow your focus and you pick a specific niche like y'all have, then it naturally leads to, like you were saying, very similar problems creeping up again and again and again. Yeah. And whether or not you build an application, a managed package to distribute on AppExchange like you all have, whether or not you do that, it at least allows you to kind of productize your service offering, even if it's all in-house. And I feel like that's a smart way to actually be able to scale. Because if you have bespoke implementations and projects for each and every client, that's a model that just won't scale long term. You can grow your company, you can get more consultants, of course, but without the ability to train everyone on this is our model, this is how we handle this problem, and this is our exact target ICP, I think it's very difficult to really hit that growth lever with an SI partner. So it's very cool that you guys early on realized, no, this is our swim lane. We're going to focus on this. And naturally that led to your application that Brent was so crucial in helping form.
Yeah.
So, okay. Could you walk me through the decision to earmark it as a free application? Because your story, I've heard your story a number of times from consultants and SI partners that find an issue that recurs, but they end up deciding to build a solution and charge for it. Y'all went in a different direction. Could you explain how you decided to keep it free?
Yeah, I guess in the greater scheme of things, it's a relatively like small niche solution. And it's not something that, it's niche, but it's like broad. In terms of how companies may use it or what type of company might use it. Like, it's not just going to be like our target ICP who's going to be using it. Mm-hmm. And I think the decision to make it free was partially because it wasn't going to be a huge amount of additional work on our side to get it out the door at the point that we already had it. You know, like we already had most of the build, like I say, from the previous engagements that we'd done. And like wanting to, in a sense, like give something back to the community. I think that the Salesforce community and also like the RevOps community are very big on sharing solutions and like making interesting builds and like helpful fixes kind of publicly available. Mm-hmm. So obviously when you run a business, you want to make money. But I think it is nice when you have a bit of flexibility to kind of like give back to the community. So there definitely is an aspect of that. And then third, I mean, if I'm honest with you, it's a little intimidating to figure out how would we go from a company that gets all of our revenue from professional services to getting a portion from like software, probably recurring revenue. I'm not an expert in this area, but I think that there are a lot of just logistical things that you have to take into consideration when you start to like split your income that way. I don't know if I'm ready to do that. So that's definitely one aspect, but really at this point we see it more as like a way of giving something small back to the community, a way of learning something new, you know, internally, like how to build an AppExchange app. And also sort of like a way to build additional brand awareness.
Sure, that makes sense. Like, it certainly, if nothing else, could maybe be a lead gen tool, right? Mm-hmm. And then work toward you with demand gen for your services. But did you build out the application? It's completely free and not like a freemium model where, you know, there are a few features that, oh, you got to work with us if you'd like to have this enabled or anything like that.
It's completely standalone. Like, if you want to work with us, please. My LinkedIn DMs are open, but it's like a standalone. There's no freemium. It's just pure, like, free. Download the app, get it up and running.
Very cool. Very cool. And so we actually got connected through Peter Ganza. Another shout out to this time to the App Exchange Whisperer. Mm-hmm. So I'm assuming that he was instrumental in helping you guys create that listing. So could you talk about that process maybe and how the kind of lead gen has been going and the traction you've seen?
Yeah, so I have to admit this isn't my strongest area because it's really been my team who's been instrumental in getting things set up and running. So like I said, Brent on my team is really like the technical mastermind. Mark, who runs up, who heads up delivery on our side, like I think he was one of the ones who sort of identified this as an opportunity as well. My marketer as well, like she really helped in, figuring out like, hey, what should the launch campaign look like? So I felt like I would be remiss in acting like, you know, I was the driving force here in any extent.
It sounds like you're still the glue, managing all these folks that are helping everything. And it's interesting too. I think a lot of early founders, they form their own business, whether it's solely services or whether it's an application, but they find themselves, they initially start for the added freedom that entrepreneurship can provide, only to essentially build the walls around them and get locked into all the day-to-day and operations. It sounds like you've done an amazing job, though, at keeping about delegating and making sure that you're focusing on building the business and using your talents where they can provide the most value. So maybe we could take a pause and just talk about how you went about with your first hires at Candybox, who they were in terms of role, I mean, maybe give us a sense of the size of the team when you founded versus today.
Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you. That's very kind. I feel like most founders, I think you get into the mindset of like things can always be better and like focusing on the things you don't feel are working how you want rather than thinking about the things that have gone really well. So it's always nice to get a reminder. When I founded Candybox, it was just me. In the early days, I relied quite a lot on contractors. I used a few trusted people that I knew from companies that I had worked at, so like people I had worked with in the past, or even people where I'd like interviewed at their company and stayed in touch with them because we got on really well. So I started out like that. I think that using contractors can be a really good way for consulting businesses to keep some flexibility, because sure, you often don't know exactly how much business you're going to have at any given time. You might have 1 month where nothing happens, and you might have another month where suddenly you get like three new customers come in, and so you need to be able to flex up and down. But I was always interested in having an in-house team. I do know of people who have decently large consulting practices, and it's all contractors still, so it's definitely viable, but I wanted to have a team of employees. So I think the first time I looked into that was about a year into running the business, and what I experimented with at the time was having some people based out of Europe These days, the majority of our business is in the US. But back then, you know, because of the fact that I'm from England originally and I was living in the Netherlands, like I had a lot of business with companies like in the Netherlands, Germany, UK, countries like that. So I set up a small team there. I hired two people, I think, to give me some optionality. Both of them were technical consultants. It was definitely good to hire two because one of them decided after a few months that he wasn't feeling consulting anymore. He'd been doing it for too long and he went into like an in-house role. But the other one stayed with us for a while. And from there, I guess I was able to start feeling out, building out the US team. I definitely don't think I would be alone in saying it was really intimidating the first time I hired people. You know, with contractors, it feels more like, you know, a lot of them have multiple clients or they're even doing things on the side and have a regular full-time job. So it's like if I don't give them work or the work dries up, it's not the biggest deal. They'll find another gig or they'll just, you know, focus on their full-time job for the moment. But, you know, when you actually hire somebody, they're usually leaving another role to come and work with you. And so, like, I really didn't want to put somebody's career at risk. Like, I wanted it to be a good experience for them to come and work with Candybox, even though we were just like a very fledgling company. And in many ways, we still are. How did I get over that? I guess might be a logical follow-up question. I don't know. I think maybe we just hit an inflection point where it's like, no, we really do need to hire somebody. You just need to, you know, you just need to do it and do your best and like learn as you go. And we definitely have made, you know, I have definitely made lots of, you know, mistakes along the way. I did have management experience before I started the company, but I think it's very different when you're managing a team at somebody else's company versus managing people at your own company. And like, you are really the one in charge of everyone's careers. Like the buck stops with you. When you're a manager at a larger company, sometimes you can just, you can sort of like push decisions off to somebody else. Like, oh no, I can't do this because the higher ups say no, or, oh, this won't be possible because the company structure doesn't allow it. But like at your own company, no, it really is all about you. So you have to, you have to get good at figuring out what direction do you want to go? Like where are your boundaries? You know, what kind of, what kind of values and behavior do you want to encourage versus discourage? So don't know if that answered your question, but those
It does. And I understand it's a lot of responsibility. Right. You mentioned how it was intimidating, specifically because you felt responsible for these new hires' careers. I'm curious too. I know you had been building up using contractors, a very common model, regardless, honestly, of consulting firm stage. But when you decided to start growing your in-house team, were you? You mentioned the intimidation for their careers. What about intimidation of the financial level? Did you feel you had built up enough of an internal war chest and you had ramped up and by hiring those folks, you had enough breathing room? Or were you thinking also like, I'm just hiring, hoping the work will be there because we need the capacity in order to get the new work? Or would you go out and seek the work and then seek the employees? Does that make sense?
Yeah. So I suppose if I look back now, I didn't really have too much to worry about because let's say, I don't know, I had like three full-time people's hours and I was spreading them across contractors. Obviously, I had enough business to replace like one of those theoretical headcounts with an employee. But, you know, I did worry a lot at the time about that. A lot like, oh, what if the business just kind of dries up, or, you know, I hire somebody and it doesn't work out and I have to let them go and I've kind of like impacted their career. I would say that you know, if I were doing it again now, I don't think I would have so many worries, because now I would be able to say, okay, well, we have these many hours. We've been doing these many hours for the last X months. Even if, you know, one of our customers, you know, reduces their commitment or they churn or whatnot, we're still going to have enough for, you know, myself and for another person and probably for another contractor. So I think I would be looking at things differently. I was probably very, like I probably had a very low risk tolerance back then, even though I didn't feel like it. Like I had built up mostly just through not having a life myself while I was starting the business. I like built up like a cushion of cash. And I think that it was definitely like that in part that made me feel more confident hiring somebody. Yeah, I was just in that stage. It was just like work, 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 and basically nothing else. So sure. Nothing really to spend the money on.
And the cushion that you built up, was it all bootstrapped or did you do any fundraising from friends and family or investors?
No, it's all bootstrapped. Yeah, I never know what to call it for consultancies because I do think it's really common, you know, not to raise money. I do know of a couple consulting practices that have, but I think it's not really the norm. Unless there's something specific that they want to do, like building some kind of product or maybe like launching in a new geo. Mm-hmm. Like one of the benefits of this model, as opposed to, you know, starting a tech company, say, is that you start generating income immediately. So you're immediately, unless you're doing something wrong, like cash flow positive, which is not the case for a lot of software companies. You know, you have to actually build your product first, and then you have to find your first customers and get your product market fit and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. But if you start a consulting company as just a solopreneur, or what you want to call it, you know, then you're just immediately generating income. And you can save it, you can invest it in the business, you can hire people with it. It definitely gives you early flexibility.
Are you struggling to make sense of the Salesforce Security Review? It's the number one roadblock slowing down your AppExchange launch. Security Review Partner translates those complex reports into a simple, prioritized checklist. Stop deciphering jargon and start shipping faster. Get the clear, step-by-step guidance you need to pass the review with confidence. Simplify your path to market. Visit securityreviewpartner.com today. That's securityreviewpartner.com.
Right, right. The flexibility of having that war chest to grow the team is paramount. Yeah. So getting back to custom quote sync. So, you mentioned earlier that you had a team member that helped you with the campaign launch. Could you talk a little bit more about what y'all did together to do that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we did a bit of exploration prior to the launch. Like some paid options, which is quite interesting. Like there are a lot of companies out there, ones that either do, like they publish reviews on their websites or they publish video reviews, or sometimes like LinkedIn posts. Mm-hmm. And you can get them to provide a review of your product for, I mean, the prices vary. Like some of them are sort of like $300, $500. Some of them are thousands, or even into like the tens of thousands. So for us, it was definitely a case of, well, this is a free product. So I don't think it makes sense to spend that much on the marketing side. So we decided to mostly use more budget-friendly channels. So I have a decent following on LinkedIn. The company page also has a decent following. So we were primarily using that to kind of launch the app. We also made a Reddit post, which got actually a lot of traction, like the post on, I think it was on just like the Salesforce community. Mm-hmm. In Reddit, like got a load of views and some downloads. We did a little bit of paid promotion on LinkedIn. Like you can promote individual posts to get wider reach. Beyond that, like we are still looking into like getting the app picked up and published on, you know, some of these sites that will review things like that. But it's been a bit slower because a lot of them will have kind of like a backlog of things that they're publishing on a certain schedule. So I guess a tip for companies that do want to pursue that route is definitely, you know, get your ducks in a row ahead of time, you know, if you want to make sure that it's going to be live by a certain date.
Are there any sites in particular that you could name that are good resources for Salesforce app reviews?
I'm trying to remember. Salesforce Ben is obviously a really, really big one.
Sure.
But there are a lot of other players. They're either smaller or more focused on a specific like vertical or like type of product. I'm afraid I can't remember any of those off the top of my head. I can always look them up and give you them to put in the episode description if we need them.
Sure. Maybe we can add later in the show notes.
We'll add like a text over or something.
Sure. Very cool. Okay. So, and you mentioned you also did some paid promotion on LinkedIn, as well as you mentioned that you have a fairly large following on LinkedIn. So, I think, you know, the problem a lot of founders face when they release their new app is they focus so much on the development, which is easy to do. It's easy to just get heads down, go in the lab and work there. But then you have your eureka moment, you finish the application and you realize no one's around to appreciate it. Right.
Yeah.
So could you talk first, maybe how did you start building up your network on LinkedIn? Was that intentional? Because I do think that's a great resource to have when it comes to product launches.
Yeah. So let me see. I've had LinkedIn for a really long time now. And I guess when I was in in-house roles, I wasn't super active in, you know, adding people to LinkedIn, just, you know, some colleagues that I was close with or people that I'd studied with in the past, things like that. When I started CandyBox, I got a bit better at adding people, prospects, contacts, partners. So I think even though I wasn't thinking too deeply about LinkedIn at that time, I did start to slowly build things up back then.
Were you posting regularly too, or mostly just reaching out for connections?
Yeah. When I started the company, I did start posting more. Although at the time, sometimes it would be, if I remember correctly, like, hey, this is an interesting tool or an interesting technical solution. Other times it would just be shouting out my team, announcing hiring, you know, like we're hiring for this role or we just hired this person and kind of introducing them via LinkedIn. Or sometimes celebrating like customers raises or like something they achieved. But I could see, or I have seen for the last couple of years, that founder-led marketing or founder-led thought leadership, whatever you want to call it, is really, really valuable, and it can be super impactful on LinkedIn. Like there are a lot of people that I follow who I genuinely believe they've primarily grown their companies through LinkedIn posting sort of gaining awareness through LinkedIn. So I've known for a while, like, hey, I should be doing more here. But I think it did take for me investing a bit more in marketing, like starting to work with fractional marketers for me to be able to do it. Some people, I think they can always just rattle off a LinkedIn post. But for me, I often need to think about it. I'm like, what do I want to write about? And what would be the angle? And like, what are some ideas that I might have? And so working with marketers, it helped me get over like some of those initial hurdles. And we would do things like have content calls where we would just throw some ideas around, like, hey, what are some things that happened with customers this last week? What are some interesting things that you've heard talking to prospects recently? What are just random things that are on your mind? And then we would generate ideas and sort of like draft posts from those. And like that really helped me sort of being able to be like, okay, this is actually what I want to be posting about and, you know, finding my voice. And also somebody in your ear who's like, Catherine, you haven't posted this week. You need to post. Like, what's this? I also find that to be a very good forcing function.
Yep. Getting the homework assignment helps.
Mm, yeah. Although I haven't posted all this week, so I probably should do that.
Well, that's very cool. I think sometimes people get in their own heads and don't realize they have a lot of valuable information and knowledge and
yeah.
wisdom to share.
Yeah.
So there are far too many folks staying silent. Although one trend that seems to be popping up more and more is the use of AI mm-hmm. to generate yeah. these posts. So it'll be interesting to see too long term if LinkedIn remains a great channel for folks to be growing mm-hmm. growing on. I know you mentioned that you know many people that have specifically grown their company on it. I've seen that as well. You know, it'll be interesting to see how AI changes that among a number of other things.
Yeah, I think it's tough because so my personal stance is like it's fine to use it maybe to like generate some ideas or just like, you know, what would be a framework for talking about this particular topic, but just like doing the entire content generation using AI, not so much my style.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think, I don't know, there's a lot of posts on LinkedIn where just the way they're written, it sets off those alarm bells. But you can never know for sure. And there are some things about the LinkedIn algorithm, at least from my understanding, that I think causes people to write in a way that does seem a little stilted or unnatural. Yes. Like, and I definitely do this from time to time too, where you like split your content over multiple lines. And with the first two lines of a post, you have to kind of, you don't have to, but it often can be valuable to turn it into a bit of a hook.
Sure.
So you try and grab attention with those first two lines so that people will then like click into the post and read more. And I do think that some of those tactics, sometimes they're just AI, you know, like somebody's been like, hey, write me a post on topic X and do it, you know, in LinkedIn format. But sometimes it's just people trying to not game the algorithm exactly, but make sure that their post just doesn't get lost, because that can happen easily on LinkedIn. Sometimes you'll post something and it just vanishes, and it gets, I don't know, like 100 views when other posts you've written get, you know, 5,000 or 10,000. And so I think people who are serious about posting on LinkedIn, they definitely want to avoid things like that.
Sure. You mentioned that with launching the application, you also boosted mm-hmm. and promoted a few posts. I think a lot of founders are curious about paid promotion, whether it's Google AdWords campaigns, whether it's promoting Facebook ads or LinkedIn ads. I'm curious, mm-hmm. How did that LinkedIn ad campaign work out for y'all? Did you feel like it did drive a lot of eyeballs toward your listing and drive a lot of installs?
Mm-hmm. So for us, yes, it did. I think I couldn't tell you exactly how we did it because my marketer set this up, but there's ways of being more or less budget conscious on LinkedIn and sort of getting views or eyeballs, like you say, without spending a huge amount of money. So we were sort of pursuing that avenue. But yeah, the post, as far as I know, that got the most traction out of everything so far was the Reddit one, which that might just be because of the type of application this is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, perhaps people who are on Reddit like found it more intriguing than the people that we have on LinkedIn. You know, I think on on Reddit, you have a lot of technical folks, a lot of admins, developers, people who are like hands-on in Salesforce day to day. And at least on my LinkedIn, I do have some people like that, especially candidates, people that I've worked with. But I also have a lot of more senior RevOps people who are maybe not as hands-on anymore and might not be, you know, as intrigued with a solution like this. So yeah, in summary, TLDR, I should say, seeing as we're talking about Reddit. Yeah, the Reddit post was the biggest attention getter for us.
That's interesting. I was going to ask if there, I know you'd mentioned Reddit earlier. I was going to ask, beyond LinkedIn and Reddit, are there any other channels or social media that you're active on that you've seen as a growth channel?
I'm not really right now, but there are some where I think, oh, if I had more time, I would definitely get back on these channels. So there's some Slack communities that are amazing. And I have previously been on, and I found contacts, even customers through them before. I just don't really have time to be in and out and like engaging in those at the moment.
Are these public Slack workspaces that you could share?
Yeah, I think so. So this is more specific to RevOps as opposed to just Salesforce. But there was one I used to like a lot called Wizards of Ops. I think RevGenius has one. There's one for women, which is Women in Revenue, I think it's called. I can go and double check these afterwards. And then there's a lot of communities as well, where I couldn't tell you off the top of my head which ones are free and which ones have a paid membership, but like RevGenius, RevOps Co-op, there's Pavilion, which is not, as far as I know, that's not Slack focused, but like they do in-person events, they have sort of like management and exec tracks. Yeah, if I were going to focus in that area a bit more, I'd definitely pick one or two of these communities to be part of. But I will say something I've seen in the last year or so coming back more is in-person events. So obviously one's ability to go to those is going to be dependent on, you know, do you have the budget as an individual or as a company? And where are you based as well? But, you know, if you can make it to, say, just like one or two of these events, it can be hugely beneficial in growing out your network. Like,
isn't there a Mexico Dreaming event coming up?
Yeah, I will give a shout out to Mexico Dreaming as well, because I went, when was it? It was in November, I think. They did a great job. It was really fun. I think a lot of dreaming events, I don't know, they're always different. They always have their kind of local flavor. And the thing I really liked about Mexico Dreaming was it was super friendly, super personable. Like everybody was talking. The organizers made sure that you got introduced to people as you arrived, so that you weren't just kind of meandering around, you know, trying to find somebody to speak to. They had a mariachi band in the closing ceremony. So yeah, if you ever need an excuse to come out to Mexico, then Mexico Dreaming, I would definitely recommend that.
Yeah, it's a business trip.
Exactly.
Very cool. And have you, with either Salesforce-sponsored events or Salesforce-directly sponsored events or some of these Dreamin' events, has Candybox been a sponsor?
We haven't been a sponsor so far. I wouldn't rule it out, but mostly I've just been a speaker.
Oh, a speaker, okay.
So I've spoken at a couple. I was a keynote, well, not a keynote speaker, but like a panel speaker at another one. I think if I continue to do that, the way I would approach it is by maybe thinking a bit more about what topic I really want to cover and how that ties back to the business. And so like find a topic that's interesting, for people and sort of topical, but also is relevant to the work that we do.
Sure, that makes sense. I mean, it can be a great way to showcase expertise and again, kind of leads back to demand gen.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I've seen some interesting presentations as well. Some people are really good at putting in some kind of lead magnet or lead generation asset as part of their presentation, but in a way where they are delivering something of value to the listeners. So for example, like I'm thinking about one presentation particularly where they're talking about a certain type of tool. It's like introduction to this type of tool. What are your options? What's the history? How should you think about it? And the person giving the speech, you know, is the founder of one of these companies. But they offer as a lead magnet, like, I've done all this research on all of the options that are out there in the market, and I have a spreadsheet. If you want me to share it with you, you just need to give me your email address. And obviously, they get the email address and sort of a potential connection with somebody who they know is interested in this space. But the person who's giving the email address actually gets like something that's very valuable in return. Almost like competitive analysis that, not competitive, but vendor analysis that would have taken a really, really long time for them to do otherwise. So I might consider something like that. Like I don't think that dreaming presentations should feel like a sales pitch.
Sure.
And I think a lot of organizers they do their due diligence to make sure that isn't the case. But at the same time, like, there are opportunities to share things that are of value to your listeners that also, you know, give something back or get something in return for, you know, the company that's presenting. So,
yes, that makes sense. And well, and for a company like Candybox too, where, you know, your revenues are 100%, at least today, coming from pro services, you really are selling your expertise and your knowledge and, not an application. The application you have, as we've discussed, is free. So when a vendor that's, selling licenses for a SaaS application talks about their tool solely in their presentation, I think it's a little bit more of a sales pitch. But you know, you could give a talk on any sort of RevOps topic, and it would likely serve to create some leads just for Candybox because they want to work with you because you've been seen as an expert in the field.
Yeah, I mean, in an ideal world, yes. But you obviously, you never know in advance exactly how like how popular your talk is going to be. So it's always a bit of a, you know, a guessing game, like what type of people are going to be attending? What are they going to think is interesting? What can I speak to insightfully that people are also going to want to listen to?
Sure. Yes. That's something you can't always plan for. You don't know what other talks are going on too. This is years ago now, but I gave a talk once at Dreamforce and I found out, unfortunately, I think the night before I found out my talk was going on at the same time as a fireside chat with Michelle Obama.
Oh.
So, you know, I felt bad. I wanted to reach out to Michelle and tell her that probably no one's going to show up to her talk, but I wasn't able to contact her ahead of time. very cool. Well, so you know, we talked about kind of the demand gen, lead gen from going to these treatment events. Also, obviously, we also talked about the App Exchange, and that's another avenue where when people install your application, you're receiving emails and possibly could turn into future services. So I'm curious, I can't quite recall the exact launch date of your application, but have you seen some installs come through that led to new business for Candybox?
To be honest with you, not yet.
Okay. We've got quite. And how long have you been?
For 2 months, maybe.
Okay, so it's very early days.
Yeah, it's early days. So we've got our installs. I see them come through. I have them set up to ping my Slack channel. but not all of them are in our ICP. And like you said, it's early days so far.
Sure. Sometimes it takes a while too. You plant the seed and you're going to have to wait a long time before that sapling starts to grow. So it makes sense to at least get the ball rolling, even if it's not going to be this quarter or even this fiscal year. Just kind of it can help start that sales cycle, I think.
Yeah.
With little to no effort from your team, because the application is just up there.
Yep.
So very cool. Well, we should start wrapping up here, but before we do, I just want to ask, is there any advice you would give to a fellow SI partner that is considering dipping their toe into the ISV space and creating a package for the AppExchange?
Yeah, I feel like maybe I'm stealing a bit of what you said earlier, but maybe making sure that you're not thinking just about the technical aspects of launching an app, but also more holistically, what does your marketing plan look like? Do you have a nurture plan for any leads that you generate? What's your support plan? You know, once you've launched it and people are actually like asking questions, you know, do you have somebody who has time allotted for those kinds of things? So yeah, I think it can be easy to get wrapped up in like the development side and, you know, the security review and all of that. But, you know, you're really launching a product. So it will, I would say, I think it's worth the extra time and energy to think about the wider aspects of supporting that product and making it a success going forward.
Sure. That makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. Well, Catherine, thank you so much for taking some time to join us, talk about your experience founding Candybox and the custom quote sync application. Where can folks go to learn more about you or Candybox or the application?
So anybody who's listening who'd like to add me on LinkedIn, please feel free. There are not many Catherine Castles based in Mexico, so I think I should be relatively easy to find. And then our RevOps is candyboxcrm.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. And best of luck to Candybox team and the new custom quote sync application.
Thank you so much, Scott. I really appreciate you having me today.
Cheers.
Building an AppExchange business can be isolating. Are you tired of guessing what the right next move is to grow and scale? Don't go it alone. ISV Forge surrounds you with a curated group of fellow ISV founders who are on the same journey. We combine peer accountability with expert-led weekly webinars to help you overcome roadblocks and build a thriving business. Stop guessing and start scaling. Apply for the next cohort today at isvforge.com. That's isvforge.com.